You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Very Lynchian feel.
I thought you were just being experimental and trying to do something different.
Did you like the style that he chose?
Convenient storytelling.
It is a check your brain at the door movie.
I don't think he lets things like continuity bother him.
This entire cast is great.
This sucks. I'm not watching this again. Why didn't he get with us? Because we always know how to fix these things.
So we can just jump into a car and drive to the mythical monster city?
That makes my gaydar ping. A little bit.
It scared the crap out of me. Of course, a smile in general is creepy to me. It's like British children.
I'm telling you, them hobbits are gay. And that's why, folks, tune back in, because I know how to poke the bear.
You're the warrior. You've got to go into the horrible forest that's scary and terrifying, and you've got to kill the monster and rescue the princess.
That's Mario. Hello, hello, hello out there in YouTube and podcast land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that lift and or separate them from the average genre fare. Are you new to us? Well, we would like to welcome you. David Horton and I have been talking movies for a very long time, predominantly horror and science fiction movies. I lean more horror. He leans more science fiction. We've been doing this for so long that we eventually decided, hey, let's do a podcast. And eventually that podcast rolled over into a YouTube channel as well. We've been doing it for 9 seasons. Each season we cover 40 to 50 movies in a 100-year span. So we pick a couple from each decade. We try to mix things up, give you a little bit of variety. And basically, that's what we do. We're in our 9th season and on our 4th. And, well, it's our 4th film and our 300th episode. So Woo-hoo! You picked a good one to start with if that is, this is your first one. Otherwise, you're coming back because you already know this and we would like to welcome you back. I am here with my co-host and good friend, David Horton. David, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm doing great. I'm really excited, of course, because it's our 300th and it's an excellent choice of a film for our 300th. We usually ice break by what do we do in our genre week and everything else. And I've kind of been saving one just because I thought it would be appropriate as a good lead in to what we're talking about today. I watched all 3 of the first John Wick movies. I had never, ever seen them before.
I think I've only seen the film.
Yeah. I had seen the first one a few months ago and then finally decided, okay, I got to see what the whole, because I watched the first one and went, eh, okay. But I don't know why it's this huge franchise. Again, I'm not a Keanu fan, so that kind of added to it. But he's doing what Keanu does best, which means he has maybe 10 lines in the whole freaking movie.
He looks intense.
He just looks intense the whole time and does all this gun-fu or whatever, as Joe Powell calls it. But so I thought, okay, what's this franchise deal? Because now I think they're getting ready to do a 6th one or something.
I was going
to
say, I think there's 4 out, and you said you watched 3, right?
Correct. So okay. I watched the trilogy, the first 3, and I just don't get it. I'm going to have to sit with Joe Powell and let him tell me what is redeeming about this franchise. It doesn't have any of the redeeming qualities of a James Bond or anything like that. It doesn't have major thematic stuff. The first one did. The first one, if you don't know John Wick, I don't know, but the first one
People know him because he's got 4 films out.
a retired assassin, international assassin, who ends up toying with a local mafioso's son. The son ends up robbing his house, stealing his car, and dun-dun-dun, killing his dog. Not a good thing at all. So that becomes the impetus for the whole Godfather 3 thing of just when you think you're out, they drag you back in sort of thing. So Basically, the whole movie is him getting vengeance on what he thinks he deserves because they killed his dog and took his car.
Isn't he reluctant to come back into this job before he's forced into it?
Correct.
Yeah.
And we know that he is reluctant just because he keeps looking at a picture of him and a woman, I assume his wife, and she's not there.
Yeah.
So you don't know because he never says anything. There is no backstory. There's no flashback. There's none of that. We are dealing with almost his POV all the way through, except for the gangster's POV, the guys that he's hunting sort of thing. They're like, I think there's 70 or 80 kills in the first movie. Then I went to the second movie. There are over 120 kills in it. The third movie has more than that. I didn't look up the research, but it has even more than that. Basically, you find out in the second and third movies that he's part of this entire assassins guild sort of thing that has assassin hospitals in big cities and assassin hotels in different cities. And by the third one, he's wounded, he's hurt, because the second and third one are almost done, like the Harry Potter Deathly Hallows. One ends and the next one starts up the next minute sort of thing. It's one movie cut into two sort of thing.
And that's the second and third movie?
Yeah. Okay. Basically, at the end of the second movie, he's wounded and he's in the hotel safe house. You can't kill anybody in the safe house. And something happens. It's really bad. That's how the movie ends. The movie starts with that bad thing has just happened, and he has 1 hour before every assassin in the world will start hunting him. And the first half hour of the movie is almost done minute to minute of the third movie, of him trying to, what do you do now, John, sort of thing. But if you like action, I guess it's good. I just like more meat to my action. I like my action to have more story to it. There are some interesting characters. There's some erratic characters. There's no character development in anybody, and there's no real backstories for anybody. You start to learn a little bit as he meets other people and gets pulled back into the web. So I'm curious to see what 5 and 6 will be. I'm assuming 5 will be more the same, and 6 is going to be like a young apprentice that he has to train, a young Padawan, so that we can carry on the franchise.
Isn't it based on like a comic book?
That I don't know. I haven't researched it enough to know.
I was thinking it was like a comic book that was adapted for not Jackie Chan, but like just those violent martial arts movies.
I don't know.
I really don't. I liked the first one. I didn't love it. It was popcorn.
Yeah. If you like action and like gun foo, then it's good. Yeah. That's what Joe Powell calls it, because it's always him. How many people can I kill in like literally 2 seconds? And then, kick, pull, shoot in the head. Boom. We're over here, go around the corner, shoot in the head twice.
Oh, yeah.
Double tap this guy and move on.
I think gung fu is a great word, actually.
There you go.
Oh.
How about you? Did you do anything fun?
Oh, man, I did something great. I finally got around to watching 28 years later, The Bone Temple.
Bone Temple.
Yes.
I read recently, he said, there was not enough distinction between these two titles, and people didn't know that this was a new movie, and that's why it didn't do as well as the other one.
Did it not do well in the box office? I don't know.
No.
Okay. Because critics liked it better than any 28 Days Later movie.
I'm sure.
And it's directed by Nia DaCosta, who directed Candyman, the new version of Candyman. So it's not even directed by Danny
Boyle.
But it is written by Alex Garland. And I have to say, I loved this movie. I liked it even more than 28 years later, the sequel to the original, the one with Jeremy Renner and Robert Carlyle. Remember, first of all, two things I told you when I last talked about this movie when it was coming out. I think we did a Coming to Get You or something. No, I talked about 28 years later, and I was telling you that they're evolving it into a new trilogy, and that Danny Boyle's going to come back and do the final one, and that Alex Garland's writing them, and this is either the first or second one, depending on where 28 Years falls. This, but what I told you when I was telling you about 28 Years later is that it's evolving into something more than a zombie movie. It's more like an adventure film. This continues that, but even more so, because it goes totally into Mad Max land, and it is not for the faint of heart at all. It is dark, and it is disturbing.
Okay.
As I mentioned, it was directed by Nia DaCosta, written by Alex Garland. A synopsis is, it follows the 12-year-old Spike, who is the kid from 28 Years Later that survives that movie, as he is drawn into a satanic cult led by Sir Lord Jimmy Crystal in a post-apocalyptic Britain. Concurrently, Dr. Ian Nelson, Ralph Fiennes, who was also in 28 Years Later, has been studying the Rage virus in his Bone Temple, which is those towers of skulls in the commercials, forming a strange connection with an alpha infected that is dubbed Samson. So there is a
bub
character, yes, in this movie, and his name is Samson. And he's one of the alphas of the zombies, and Rafe is finding out more about him. Or should I say Dr. Kelson is finding out more about him. And I'm telling you, man, this movie rocks. I was into it the whole time I was watching it. It is an excellent cast, including those two I said that return, plus Jack O'Connell and Aaron Kellyman. And that Jack O'Connell plays the leader of the satanic cult. And he's in the very end of 28 Years Later. And he is a fucking psychopath. The movie gets 92% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's higher than, like I said, any of the other in the franchise, because 28 Years got 88, 28 Weeks got 70. I don't know what – I didn't put what 28 Days got. But anyway, I don't know that I like – I don't like it better than 28 Days Later. I will always like the first one the best. But this one's right up there at probably number two.
And they're doing a third?
There's another one coming, yeah. And I don't know if it's the Danny Boyle one, because when they, it's very confusing because they say it's a second trilogy, but I think the first movie of the trilogy was the third of the original trilogy. So maybe there's only one movie coming.
Wait, but you got Years Later, then Years Later, Bone Temple. And then
so see, this
later,
could potentially
next.
Be the second movie.
I would think it is. Yeah.
But that means the first movie was the third, though, of the first trilogy. So does it overlap that way? I guess it could. It would make sense. It would be okay if it did. So anyway,
yeah, I
recommend it. So that's what I did. I went to a temple, and it wasn't the Temple of Doom.
Right, because Temple of Doom, we know, is the second one in the trilogy of the first one we're talking about today, which we're excited about. This is our 300th episode. And I think we should preface everything by saying thank all of you who have supported us since we first started this realm or this endeavor 9 seasons ago. And I never knew we would get to 300 episodes. That's kind of cool and amazing, really.
God knows there's more than that many movies out there.
Yeah, and by episodes, that's just our episodes. A lot of times, every season, we do double features, so we've covered more than 300 films in our series. But today, we are covering what arguably, I know for me personally, is one of the greatest movies ever made. It is in my top 5 movies of all time, in my opinion. For a lot of people, it falls into like a lot of the same category as one of the greatest films ever made. It came out in 1981. It's this tiny little jewel written by Lawrence Kasdan with help by George Lucas and Philip Kaufman, directed by Steven Spielberg, starring Harrison Ford, Karen Allen, and it's called Raiders of the Lost Ark.
3,000 years, man has searched for the lost Ark of the Covenant.
The Bible speaks of the Ark leveling mountains and laying waste to entire regions.
Not something to be taken lightly. No one knows its secrets.
Jones, do you realize what the Ark is? It's a transmitter. It's a radio for speaking to God.
An army which carries the Ark before it is invincible.
The Ark, if it is there, Atanis, then it is something that man was not meant to disturb.
It is protected by forces beyond imagination. It is desired above all treasures on Earth by those who are good.
Trust me.
And those who are evil.
I'll tell you everything.
Yes, I know you will.
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Let her go.
We have no time if you still want the Ark. It has been loaded onto a truck for Cairo.
Raiders of the Lost Ark. A film from Steven Spielberg and George Lucas.
Hopefully we will not make this episode 300 hours long.
No.
But
you have 1 hour.
We have 1 hour and that's it. But I'm really curious to see, we like to start with what's the first time you saw it. Let me do a synopsis first, because we're supposed to, in case you haven't seen this movie, why haven't you, where have you been, and what have you been doing? Basically, we begin in 1936, so it's a period piece. But it's in color, for those of you who suddenly have a problem with period pieces being in black and white. But we are following an archaeology professor named Indiana Jones, and we slowly follow his adventures as he is conscripted by the United States government, some covert part of the government, to find and return the Lost Ark of the Covenant, which is only talked about in the Bible and is only rumored to have ever existed, but supposedly it could be a major weapon. We are building up to World War II. The Nazis are also looking for this particular could-be weapon. So we have our little archaeologist up against the Nazis for majority of the movie. It proceeds action piece after action piece until the very end, when he does retrieve the Ark and then loses it almost immediately to this covert organization. It is based on and inspired by B-movie serials like the Republic serials of the 30s and 40s. We'll go into that, I'm sure, when we go into production. But again, it is highly touted as one of the greatest films ever made. When's the first time you saw it?
I was trying to think, because it's been so long ago. What is that?
Almost, 81.
It's 45 years ago.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I saw this at the Princess Theater with my mother. Because this movie was not on my radar at all. She had heard about it from either someone she worked with or her brother that said, you need to go see this movie. And we did, and thoroughly enjoyed it.
An interesting parallel to me is I heard about this movie the same way I heard about Lucas's little Star Wars thing. It was in Starlog magazine. They had just a brief little two-paragraph thing and pictures. And the pictures were Steranko, I think he was the artist at the time, kind of like a Ralph McQuarrie. But he developed the whole look of Indiana, the fedora, the whip, the leather jacket, that sort of thing. And so the two pictures, I remember them distinctly. The two images they showed had Indiana and a truck, a great big huge ammo truck, in the background sort of thing in the desert. And then another one was him with a jungle motif behind him. And there's a great big cobra snake in the foreground looking at him. And it just said, B-movie serial inspired, new movie from George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, catch it next year, kind of thing. And so I did know about the movie. I was excited. I was already a fan, of course, of Spielberg since Jaws, and I was a fan of Lucas because Star Wars had just come out, and now Empire Strikes Back had just come out. So, of course, I was excited and wanted to see it and have loved it ever since. I've probably seen this movie 50 times, probably. I love this movie. I'll put this movie on and just fast forward to scenes just to watch how the scene develops, like the whole fight at the airport scene, or just the truck scene, or just the to validate myself about the submarine. The only thing I have no problems with any moment of this movie, except the willing suspension of disbelief that Indiana Jones rode on a periscope for about a week or more.
Yeah,
because that's how slow these things would travel at the time.
So, or that thing didn't ever go down.
Submarine never submerged, so he just.
I have that in my notes. So did he hold his breath the whole way?
In the original, I found out finally in the original screenplay that Kasdan had done, he actually found a hatch and opened it and snuck onto the submarine and then stayed there. And then they did the whole map, the dotted line as they go to the island and everything else. But because of budget cuts, they never filmed it.
So they didn't.
This movie was.
So he didn't eat for a week. or have water.
Or have water. Or go to the bathroom or whatever. But no, they highly implied in the script that he was on the submarine, hiding out on the submarine. Again, my only foible with the entire movie. I think it's brilliant. I think it's so well done. I think it did so much to influence film and everything else, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But huge constraint in productions of this. This was, do you know the history or do you know how it started or do you have it in your notes?
I know they all got food poisoning except for Spielberg.
Wait, let's go back before that. So Lucas actually started developing this in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s. He wanted to do a serialized movie. Like the ones that he loved. So inspired by, like I said, all the Republic serials, but he really wanted to do Flash Gordon. He wanted to do a new remake of Flash Gordon. He couldn't get the rights. He couldn't do it. So he started working on his other idea, which was this little Star Wars thing that he did. Got huge press for it, of course, and it was the success it was and all of that. He then, by this time, Spielberg had done Jaws and Close Encounters, but then had done 1941. And so Spielberg, which tanked. So Lucas is known as this. They're both known as the Wunderkinds of Hollywood, kind of making their marks kind of thing. But Lucas is known as the guy who makes this little bitty movie that didn't cost that much, $9 to $11 million, and ended up making gajillions. Spielberg, however, is known as going 100 days over budget and overshooting schedule on Jaws and over budget, over schedule and over budget on Close Encounters, over budget and over schedule on 1941. So he's not really popular with the studios.
Okay.
They think he's a money loser sort of thing. They had to, because they all went to USC. So all of them, we've talked about that before, even down to the Brian De Palmas and the George Milius and all of them were in the same classes at USC and looked at each other's movies. And
it was like Coppola too, wasn't it? Or with
Yeah, Coppola was there too. Yeah. Yep. Spielberg was the one that suggested to Lucas that he put the crawl in at the beginning of Star Wars. Anyway, they had developed this tradition because they're good friends. On the opening of either of their movies, they will take their wives and families and everything else to Hawaii and wait out the opening weekend. So they did that as a thing, and they would build sandcastles and talk and dream. And Empire Strikes Back is opening, so they go to Hawaii, and they're on the beach making sandcastles. And Lucas says, I really want to do this serial thing I've been thinking about. And Spielberg goes, you know what I want to do? And he goes, what? And he goes, I want to do a James Bond movie. I want to do a James Bond movie so bad. I've talked to them already, but they are such a close-knit family. They won't let me in there at all. And they think I'm going to make it too over budget. And I got to find my next project has to be on time and under budget. And Lucas goes, I think I have a project for you. And they started talking about Raiders of the Lost, what at that time was called The Adventures of Indiana Smith.
Yeah.
That was the original name. Spielberg didn't like the title. Indiana Smith was the name of Lucas's dog, however, and that was actually true, so trivia-wise. Anyway, so they started talking about the idea. They basically said, Spielberg basically said, all right, when the tide comes in, if this sandcastle we just built stays up, I'll work on your movie with you. If not, I'm going to go off and do my own project, which I'm toying with some other ideas of what I want to do. So tide came in, castle stayed, they started working on it.
Wow.
Next step. Spielberg wants to use Lawrence Kasdan to do the screenplay because he really liked the screenplay for Empire Strikes Back. He thought it was very well written. He also liked, what was his one he did right before that?
He did Big Chill after it. I know that.
Continental Divide, the one with John Belushi.
Okay.
He did that one. And
Blair Brown. Blair Brown.
Yeah. Good memory.
Yeah.
So what they did was they found a room. And they spent 3 days crafting the entire screenplay for Raiders of the Lost Ark. Not line by line, but at least beat by beat and what they wanted and everything else. You can still find that, the transcripts of those 3 days of meetings. I actually have a copy of those transcripts. And it is so cool to hear like Spielberg. It'll say, Spielberg says, what if he just used a whip? And Kasdan goes, a whip? Nobody uses a whip. Why would he use a whip? And Lucas goes, no, that's really a cool idea. A whip's, I haven't seen that in a while. And that's very swashbucklery, blah, blah, blah. And so anyway, it's so great to hear these three guys craft this whole story to go along with it. And how do we have the cliffhanger? How do we keep the progress going? How do we make it work?
But Spielberg made changes that I think are for the best in this film.
Yes,
because
definitely
Lucas's version of Indiana was not anywhere near as endearing to the general public as what Spielberg gave us.
Correct.
Yeah. And Spielberg wanted him to be a teacher that kids have crushes on, whereas Lucas wanted him to be like a ladies' man that's Bond sleeping with women and
A womanizer and an alcoholic. Yeah. He wanted him to be a recovering alcoholic.
Everything Spielberg did made him more of like the guy.
The hero.
Yeah, the hero's journey. Who is it that says that? I was trying to think of his name. Campbell? Joseph Campbell, yeah.
Before we jump into a little bit more production, what about scenes? So what scenes? How do you pick scenes in Raiders of the Lost Ark?
I could do what you always do and say the opening, because the entire opening is him going after that little gold statue with all the craziness that he goes through to get it. And then, of course, when he gets out,
Belloc
is there to steal it from him.
Unfortunately, you don't speak Jovitos, Dr. Jones.
Yeah. And it's got, I had forgotten that Alfred Molina is in this movie. It's his first movie. And I was like, who is that? I know that guy. Because I haven't seen this movie in it.
Yeah.
And when I watched it the other night, I was like, wow. So that scene, for sure.
The next one I would do is I like the hiring scene. I really like the way he shot the whole scene meeting with the CIA guys and talking about the Ark and the book, and he's got the chalkboard and everything else. I like that scene a lot. I think it's well done.
Yeah, it's a lot like the hiring of Quint in Jaws. Now let's think about
Interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. That's a great key. Tibet. The whole Tibet-Nepal scene.
Is that the when they all had food poisoning and he shoots the samurai?
No, that's when they introduce Marion and she's doing the drinking contest.
Oh, yeah.
And then that's Indy great. Shows up. Indy leaves. Then Tote shows up. And then Indy comes back.
And the medallion is in the fire there in the open the whole time when the guys are there to get it. That's just right there in front of them. Yeah.
Great MacGuffins.
Yeah, Dennis watched this with me. he had not seen it, or he had not seen it in a long time. I don't know if he had ever seen it, because
God, so good.
We've done so many Disney things, and we've done the Indiana Jones stunt show a billion times. So sometimes he's, I think I've seen the movie, but I'm not sure. I mean, because you've seen so many pieces of it, you feel like you've seen the movie. So he watched it with me, and that whole time he was like, can't they see that necklace is right there, or that amulet is right there? And I love it when the guy grabs it and just goes running screaming because it burns his head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The truck scene is classic.
And the stagecoach stunt where he goes under it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that entire chase from the minute of him not only doing over it, but getting onto it to begin with and going through the front and kicking the guy and then all the guys crawling. Harrison Ford's so good with that, and looks in the rearview mirror and the guy's on the side and he goes, and you just hear the guy fall as he smiles.
Yeah. And what's funny about Harrison in that scene is when he ends up going under the truck and having to get back on the truck and go around, you can tell he's pissed off because he goes in there and he kicks that guy out, man. It's like, so damn. Yeah.
That's great scene.
So he's not a two-dimensional character. That's another thing that's great about Ford playing this, is because he's so deep. Yeah.
And about the design, too, what they wanted with it and the way they crafted the character. So that it's not just, we just talked about it, and that's kind of why I did it as a bridge or as a what I watched this week. John Wick is a cipher. He is angry the entire time, and that's just it. There's no nuance to his character. And this, in one action scene, has so many, some comedy, some anger, some great stunts, some incredible photography. It's just a good sequence. The Well of the Souls, again, is another one of my favorite scenes. The whole finding the Ark part with all the snakes and all of that escape and all that. And then my last two are the end. The opening of the Ark, which scared the crap out of me when I was a kid. I was going, damn, you don't mess with God. God is really, especially not a Jewish God. He can get really mad.
Yeah, Old Testament God.
Yeah, like Old Testament stuff. That's what he said. And then the final shot. You're always known for that Indy's known for that final shot of the old guy pushing the crate. You know, after Indy has gotten so mad and said, where is it? Where is the art in a safe place? Where? A safe place.
Yeah, it's with Mulder and Scully.
Yeah.
In the big warehouse. Yeah. Yeah, there's keys all over this film. So many.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's a lot about scenes. I don't know if we want to keep going because pretty much the whole movie is that. The cast could take me a minute because it's a lot.
Sure.
And very much like our last film, Misery, last week, so many people were considered for these roles. Let's see. We know Harrison Ford plays Indy, and he's done it now in five films or four?
Five. Dial of Destiny is the last one.
Yeah, I've seen that one. I think I may have missed Crystal Skull. I can't remember.
Oh, no, I saw Crystal Skull, but I have not seen Dial of Destiny yet, because Crystal Skull left me with such a bad taste in my mouth.
Yeah.
Survives a nuclear
bomb. I'm honestly not a fan of the second movie, but I really like the one with Sean Connery.
Love the photography in the second one. I'm not a big deal on the story overall, and I didn't like her. I thought she was annoying rather than...
Yes.
She and Short Round.
Both of them. Annoying. Her and the kid. And that's another thing I want to say that's great about this movie is that there's not a kid in it.
There's not a kid in the third one either, which is good.
Yeah. Maybe that's why I like the first and third one. No kids. Anyway.
Third one's great.
So, Tom Selleck was Steven Spielberg's second choice for this role. Harrison Ford was first, but Lucas had objected because Ford had been in previous movies, American Graffiti, Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back. So he wanted to use someone different. Selleck couldn't take the role.
Yeah, he said he didn't want to be Scorsese to De Niro. He didn't want to be Lucas to Ford. The same way Scorsese always cast De Niro.
De Niro. And that's exactly what Lucas said. But this is not a Lucas movie. This is a Spielberg movie.
Come on.
Selleck could not take the role because of Magnum P.I., which was shooting at the time. Others, Sam Neill was considered, Sam Elliott, Jeff Bridges, Paul LaMatt, Christopher Guest, Bruce Boxenleitner, Barry Bostwick, Harry Hamlin, Mark Harmon, Nick Mancuso, Peter Coyote, John Calvin, Michael Biehn, Sam Shepard, David Hasselhoff, Tim Matheson, Jack Nicholson, no.
No.
Nick, no, and I love Jack Nicholson, but no. Nick Nolte, John Shea, Nick Mancuso, Bill Murray, no. And Steve Martin, Willem Dafoe, and Chevy Chase, no. There's a bunch of no's in there, but there are a few big no's. Those are the ones I indicated. Yep. So anyway, fortunately, Lucas came around and Harrison ended up in the role, and no one else could ever do that role. Karen Allen plays Marion. Just a side note here, I always confuse her with the woman, and I cannot think of her name, that plays Welcome Back Cotter's wife.
Welcome Back Cotter's wife.
Yeah, the woman that was on the sitcom Welcome Back Cotter. For some reason, I always think it's Karen Allen.
Oh, no.
But I guess they look similar. She also looks a lot like, she also reminds me a lot of Margot Kidder.
Yes. Now that I could see. Totally. Yeah.
But she is her own and she's a dynamo. And I, behind the scenes as well as in front of the camera,
yeah,
we know her from a couple of other movies. She was in Animal House, which was a very popular movie at the time, which is one of the reasons she was cast. And then she went on to do Starman, which is a John Carpenter movie we have not covered with Jeff Bridges.
Jeff Bridges. Yeah.
Yeah. And several other people were considered also from that era. Jane Seymour, Barbara Hershey, Lisa Eibacher. Is that how you say that name? Eibacher?
Eibacher.
Yeah. Mary Steenburgen, Amy Irving. Big surprise there. Dee Wallace, Valerie Bertinelli. No. Linda Pearl. No. Patty D'Arbinaville, Stephanie Zimbalist, Michelle Pfeiffer would have been interesting. Deborah Winger. Deborah Winger would have probably worked. With that.
Definitely.
She's definitely a Deborah Winger type. All considered, Sean Young was used as Marion in a screen test with Tom Selleck. I thought that was interesting. Yep. Tim Matheson, who is also from Animal House, and John Shea were used as Karen Allen's screen test. So they had not cast Harrison at that point. I wanted to know some more about her because she doesn't do a lot of stuff. So I looked her up. She was a notable of Lee Strasberg alumni. Her co-fellow Strasberg people at the time were Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, who you just mentioned, James Dean, going back, Marilyn Monroe, Steve McQueen, Paul Newman, Christopher Walken, Dennis Hopper, and Matt Zemlin.
Well, Strasberg is probably my favorite coach of all the ones that came out, the Stella Adlers and the that came from Stanislavski.
So it's interesting. You should say that. We may be doing a movie with his daughter this season. Yes. And I know that you haven't seen it. Anyway, what I found out about Karen, though, is that she went to school and majored in fashion at New York's Fashion Institute of Technology. And she owns and designs clothes for her own label.
I didn't know that either.
That's why she's not doing so many movies. I think she just gets a call from Spielberg every few years saying, hey, you want to do an Indiana Jones movie?
You want to be Marion again? Come on back.
Yeah. So she's got her own business, her own money, very much like the Olsen twins, only older.
That's great.
Yeah. So
and another great thing I'll just interject here, too, is one of the great things about Marion and Karen Allen in that role is she is not a damsel in distress.
Not at all.
From her first scene where she can drink this huge guy under the table, she's on top. She hits our hero in the first scene they have together.
She sucks him.
And she is strong all the way through. But they don't make a point of saying, oh, and you are such a great, strong woman. They don't have to hit us over the head with it. She just is who she is. Yeah. And she's a great character.
Yeah, that's why the whole time when I was mentioning all those women, the other one that rang true the most to me would be Deborah Winger. I could see Deborah Winger doing that too.
Because she can also be attractive and sexy and mm-hmm. funny and all of these things together, same way that Harrison is for Indy. You have to have all of these levels. Even Belloc yeah. has all these levels.
And Deborah has a quirky voice that is not like a blonde bombshell voice. It's a very normal woman voice. She's not.
It's E.T.'s typical. Voice.
Yeah, exactly. Paul Freeman plays Belloc. He is, yep. I'm not very familiar with him. He's in a movie called The Long Good Friday, which is on my list and has been for years. I really want to see that film, and I don't ever get around to watching it for some reason. It's a Bob Hoskins movie. I don't know if you've seen it.
Okay.
Sir Jonathan Pryce and Giancarlo Giannini were considered for the role of Belloc, but it went to Paul Freeman. I knew nothing about him, but as I did some research, I read that he's one of Britain's most underrated actors and that he has played leading roles at the National Theater, the Royal Court, and the Royal Shakespeare Company. So
excellent.
He's kind of one of those big actors we would hear about, like Richard Burton, only we never heard about him. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess Spielberg was on the radar and knew. Ronald Lacey, another actor I did not know much about at all, plays Tote. But we did see him in a movie we've covered back in season 6, episode 26, Buckaroo Banzai. He played President Widmark in that movie. Spielberg had originally offered the role to Roman Polanski. Did you know that?
You could see that.
Yeah.
You could see that.
He's a real Holocaust survivor. Polanski was intrigued with the opportunity to work with Spielberg, but decided to turn it down because he wouldn't be able to make the trip to Tunisia. The role was also offered to Klaus Kinski, who wrote in his memoir, "As much as I would like to do a movie with Steven Spielberg, the script is moronically shitty."
Poor man. Poor misguided man.
And yet he did Nosferatu, the remake. Oof. And you know what he turned it down in favor of?
No.
A movie called Venom from 1981 about snakes.
Yeah, there you go. I'm sure it had a great script.
Klaus did not have a knack for picking good films, really.
Klaus.
Yeah. Sir Christopher Lee desperately wanted to play this role. After playing a Nazi in 1941, Spielberg's prior film, but apparently it didn't work out, and the role went to this guy. Oh, I know why. Because Spielberg liked the way this guy reminded him of Peter Lorre, who he would have originally wanted to cast, and, you know, had Peter Lorre been that age.
Which goes back to that whole love of the serials or the movies at that time.
Or even Casablanca or The Maltese Falcon. Yeah. John Rhys Davies, he plays Sala. We last saw him as Gimli in all three of the Lord of the Rings series that we've covered in season 6, 7, and 8.
Yep.
All episode 18, intentionally.
Yeah.
Spielberg wanted Danny DeVito to play this role, but Danny had conflicts because he was doing Taxi at the time, which was a really popular sitcom. So he went with Jonathan Rhys Davies. However, another person was offered, Kevork Malikian. Do you know that name?
I do not.
I don't either. Someone from another country. But he arrived an hour late for his interview with Spielberg because of a traffic jam. I don't know if that had anything to do with him not getting the role, but he went on to play Kazim in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Okay.
Kazim. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I don't remember that movie very well. Okay. Denholm Elliott plays Brody. Love him. Always have loved him.
Always.
Yeah. He is in A Room with a View and Trading Places. Spielberg had been a longtime fan of Denholm Elliott and was quick to cast him in the role of Marcus Brody. The reason Denholm is in my fan book is because he was one of the first actors I knew that died of AIDS but was not closeted, I guess is the word I'm looking for. He was very out about it. He was a bisexual with many partners during his life. He tested HIV in 1987 and was diagnosed in 1988. He continued working until a year before he died in 1992. Following his death, some state that he got the virus from a blood friend transfusion. However, his widow documented that they had an open marriage and his her husband's bisexuality was very well known and that it was not a blood transfusion. And that was published two years after his death.
In a lot of reviews you watch online or YouTube or whatever, they talk about the tragedy of Denholm Elliott. It's this great movie, and you didn't know that 11 years later he'd probably be dead. So that's sad.
Yes.
He was great. He's so great.
He is very good. I think I had another note. Maybe it's in my trivia about him. But anyway, love Denholm Elliott. I mentioned earlier Alfred Molina is in this movie. I had no fucking idea. He looks like a kid. He, of course, went on to play one of my favorite roles of Dr. Octopus in Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 2. But he's also in Boogie Nights as well as Magnolia. It's his first credited role, and on his very first day of filming, he was covered in tarantulas.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And a little trivia note about that, they wouldn't move. They just clung to him, so they added a female tarantula, and they all went crazy. And,
yeah.
I don't know. I adore Steven Spielberg, but if he said, oh, in your first day, you're going to be covered in spiders, I'd have to go, ooh, okay. Yeah, sure.
The whole time I was watching that, I always heard if you drop a tarantula, it dies because it's so heavy.
It depends on the height.
Because they're brushing them things off of him. And I'm like, are they all dying when they hit the ground?
No, they're probably just below his knees is where they're landing.
Like a
or
net.
Just above his knees.
Maybe.
Yeah. Probably.
Wolf Collar plays Dietrich. Was in Boys from Brazil, which is a movie that has been on our list that you've cut many times. But we'll get to it one day.
We'll get to it.
And he was in Wonder Woman. I did not know that. As well. I guess that's the remake. Not the remake, probably. But the one with Gal Gadot. That's all I have for cast. But as far as awards, wow. This movie was nominated for 9 Oscars. Best Picture, Director, Cinematography, Art Direction, Sound Editing, Visual Effects, Score, and Sound Editing. It won 4. Art Direction, Sound Editing, and Visual Effects. Oh, Sound Editing and Visual Effects. This was back when Spielberg was not getting noticed. Spielberg had a history of not getting an Academy Award for a long time. I think Schindler's List when he finally got one, wasn't it?
Color Purple, I think.
No, I don't think. I thought Color Purple was nominated for SCADS, and the only person that won was like Oprah Winfrey or something.
Oh, okay. I'll look it up real quick because that's something I need to know since he's my favorite.
I just remember he got overlooked a lot until Schindler's List, I think. Anyway, it was nominated for 9 Saturns as well. Fantasy film actor, actress, supporting actor, Freeman. Director, writing, music, costume, special effects. And it won 7. Fantasy film actor, actress, director, writer. So these smaller awards are giving Spielberg the accolades. It's the Academy Awards that took a while to come around.
And again, that's because in the Hollywood, like when they shopped this around, I didn't say it in production, when they shopped this around, every major studio turned them down because they said Spielberg will never bring it in under budget and on time. It'll never happen. And we don't want to spend $20+ million on a movie that's going to end up costing us $30 million.
See, I heard that no one would do it until they found out it was Spielberg and Lucas combined.
Lucas's clout with both Star Wars and Empire and him kind of going to bat for Steven and Steven Spielberg making the pledge that he swore, I will be under budget, I will be on time.
And he was.
And he was.
Yeah.
Yes, he was.
There are scads more wins and nominations across the board for this film. In 1999, it was added to the National Film Registry for being culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant. And it is on the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die list. And it's well-deserved.
I think...
it's a lot.
It's a huge film, and its influence is huge, which I'm sure we will talk about as we get into it and everything. I do think you mentioned it as far as the nominations, and we need to mention the fact that it has incredible cinematography, it has incredible lighting, it has incredible production design, it has great music. It is well edited. Michael Kahn did the editing. He did a lot of Spielberg's films. And it's just, the production design is, I've got him on my list too, hold on. Norman Reynolds, having to do the production design of all of this international settings and everything else was great. Trivia or production trivia before we jump into key.
Yeah, I don't really have any trivia. I'm surprised.
Philip Kaufman was who Lucas originally pitched the idea to and was talking about. So this was back in the early 70s, before Star Wars even, and everything else. And he and Kaufman would go through ideas for this Indiana Smith character. Kaufman was the one that suggested an ancient relic. And he's the one that ended up suggesting the Ark of the Covenant, which kind of was the seed to help Lucas pull this all together. So I want to give credit to Mr. Kaufman there. John Williams, of course, the music for this is great. The trivia I've got on that is Spielberg went to Williams and said, I need a theme that people will whistle when they leave. That's what I want. I know you've done Star Wars and it's orchestral and it's huge and it's great and all that, but I want something fun, light, that people will whistle when they leave. And he went back to Spielberg and said, I also want a theme that can be used in different settings. It can be adventurous and heroic, and it can also be sad. I want to be able to, motif the sound out. And he developed Marion's theme and all these other themes, what Williams does best, sort of thing.
Yeah, all the music in this is great.
Oh, it's wonderful. Mm. It was filmed in Elstree Studios, Spielberg's first shoot in the United Kingdom. It was also the first time Spielberg storyboarded the entire movie. So part of convincing Paramount that Spielberg could do it was he showed them that he already had done pre-planning for the entire movie. He knew what every shot was going to be. That being said, when they went on site, there was a lot of improvisation and a lot of changes because he realized he didn't want to go over budget. He didn't want to go over schedule. So he would do takes, whereas in the past with Jaws and Close Encounters, he would take 7 or 8 takes of a scene. He would do maybe 3. He cut himself short a lot of times, which Kahn, in the editing bay later on, didn't like a lot, but he had to do what he did. That's why there are some, if you look back at this and you're a cinephile and examine this movie, there are some strange edits. There are some continuity errors with things where they aren't right because it's a stunt scene going into a major scene, whatever, that sort of thing.
And it seemed to me like this would be a hard movie to come in under budget on because of location shooting in another country and
yes.
stuff.
Yep.
And as I mentioned before, apparently Spielberg was the only one that packed his lunch and everyone else got food poisoning that day they were shooting yep. the samurai scene. And the whole improv of him, instead of using the whip or whatever, he just pulls out his gun and shoots the guy, which is hilarious and was totally yep. because Harrison Ford was sick and just wanting to get done.
Yeah, they had an entire whip battle rehearsed and choreographed and everything. And he goes, can I just shoot him, please?
Yeah.
And they tried it once in rehearsal and Spielberg said, oh, yeah, we got to keep it. I don't care. Let's keep it.
Yeah.
That scene was improvised. The whole scene, I didn't know this, the whole scene with Marion and Belloc was improvised. They knew what they wanted, but Spielberg allowed them to just do their own lines and do their own
choreo. When she does the drinking game with him.
Yeah, and gets the knife and then ends up almost escaping, but Tote is standing there when she escaped. All of that was an improvised scene as well. Yeah. Ford did 90% of his own stunts for this, so much so that he was also injured a lot on this show.
Yeah, and he also went without treatment on some of those injuries to just keep going. Didn't he break a toe? I can't remember what it was.
He pulled tendons in his foot during the airplane fight because it rolled over his leg.
It rolled over, yeah. The tire was soft, but it still ran over him. It didn't break it, but it strained something, and he just wrapped it and kept going. Yeah.
Yep.
He was young. Yeah.
And that's another scene that was improvised. They worked out that choreo. They had a much bigger fight planned, and Spielberg didn't have the time to shoot it. He goes, I don't have time. I'm going to have to cut it down. So they improvised that fight and threw sections together. The budget was $18 million because Paramount, like I said, their budget that they proposed was $20 million. Paramount said that you would never be able to do it for that. Spielberg brought it in for $18 million. He brought it in 11 days short. So it was 11 days ahead of schedule. The first year it was released, it made $500 million.
Yeah. It's crazy. Crazy.
Yeah. It is regarded as one of the greatest films of all time. It's on a lot of people's lists. It had huge influence on going forward. So that's a good way for Keys.
I have one question before we get into Keys.
Yeah.
It's very much like the how is Harrison holding his breath on the submarine or Indiana. Why is Balak all dressed up in a turban and shit at the end?
He is dressed up like a Jewish priest because this is a Jewish artifact and he is going, or a rabbi, sorry, I said priest. Ooh, that's probably countercultural. He is dressed as a rabbi.
Because I just thought,
and that's why
he's like an archaeologist too. Why would he do that?
He may have some, I don't know, Jewish hierarchy, so to speak. But so that, yeah, that is why he.
So that's one of my other gripes. I'm like, why would he do that? That doesn't seem right. But anyway,
because it was a ceremony to open the ark, sort of thing, has always been my impression of it. Mm. Before we get into Keys 2, there's also a key from this that kind of leads to this question or this thought is the Big Bang Theory. There's an episode of the Big Bang Theory where they're all excited because they're going to get together for Indiana Jones. They watch it once a year. So the whole gang is going to get together and watch Indiana Jones, one of the greatest movies ever made, blah, blah, blah. And Sheldon's girlfriend goes, oh, wait, I think I saw that one once. That's the movie where the hero really has no effect at all on the plot and he couldn't be there and exactly everything that happens in the plot would still happen. And Sheldon goes, what? She goes, yeah, if you take Indiana Jones out of Raiders of the Lost Ark, everything still happens exactly the way it happens. They still find the ark. They still take the ark to the thing. They still open the ark. No, he has no effect on the plot at all. And I went, oh my God, I've never even thought of that before. But it became a big kind of geekdom thing, everybody talking about the hero that had no effect on the plot.
Anyway, back to Keys. You already mentioned the Republic serials, and there were more than just Republic serials, but Spielberg specifically said Republic serials. So I looked at a few of the popular ones were Lone Ranger, Captain Marvel, Dick Tracy.
Yep.
Flash Gordon's actually a different series of serials, but...
Correct, which are a big influence to Lucas as well. So right. Flash Gordon, Don Winslow, who was a secret agent, Spy Smasher... Buck Rogers, Zorro, all of those have been listed as by Lucas and Spielberg as influences. Yeah.
I was going to say, and the only reason I know this is because I remember the cheap ones that came after Indiana Jones, but they were actually written before, and it's those Alan Quatermain novels.
Yep.
Or stories, Alan Quatermain stories. He did lots of archaeological type adventure stuff. And Richard Chamberlain played him in the movies subsequent to Harrison Ford. However, I do think the books came before. I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, that is a knockoff, definitely. You had said Tom Selleck. He didn't do this movie and went on to do Magnum. There's an episode of Magnum where he parodies Raiders of the Lost Ark, where he actually, you see him with the fedora, with the whip, all that stuff. So
funny.
Thought that was fun. Also, influences that led to it, I've got, you already mentioned some, but they're not the action cliffhangers, but they are Casablanca, Maltese Falcon, Charlie Chan movies. All of those were a huge influence, I think, on this movie as well.
I could see that. Even Treasure of the Sierra Madre, maybe.
Treasure of the Sierra Madre, yeah. Maltese Falcon, you're hunting for an artifact that everybody's chasing the entire time. So, yeah, all those. Casablanca, the great chemistry between them is just like Marion and Indy sort of thing. The couple, plus the fact that you've got Peter Lorre, who is Tote, sort of thing.
Right.
Doc Savage.
I'm sorry.
That's another one. Yep.
I'm going subsequent again, movie-wise, and
yeah.
The Romancing the Stone movies, which is interesting because those scripts were around before Indiana Jones was. They just didn't get made until after the popularity of Indiana Jones with Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner and Danny DeVito.
Yeah. So. I've got that with a list of Indiana Jones kind of redefined the hero in cinema, I think, forever. So you've got not only Romancing the Stone, you've got things like Die Hard, National Treasure, The Mummy, Pirates of the Caribbean, even Guardians of the Galaxy, the way he's a bumbling hero kind of thing. So that kind of revolution, nobody was this James Bond suave anymore. Everybody, a lot of the heroes coming out then suddenly had these, they were realistic heroes, which is what Spielberg wanted in Indiana anyway, which is great.
I didn't have Die Hard. I thought I had put National Treasure on here, but I guess I had not. Okay. You said Die Hard, National Treasure, and what?
Romancing the Stone. Oh, you said The Mummy.
Oh, The
Mummy. Again.
Yeah, because those are Indiana Jones time heroes.
Oh, gosh,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. Pirates of the Caribbean. Again, you got a bumbling hero who doesn't have a plan all the time, who's making it up as he goes along, as he says.
I have The Lost City, which is a more recent kind of thing. It's about a romance writer, and basically meeting the hero of her novels.
Yeah.
I put down the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles from 1992.
Yeah.
Because I was confusing it with one because I was like, there was one in the 80s. There was one in the 80s. And the one I was thinking of was Young Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, no.
That's something different. Okay.
River Phoenix actually played Young Indiana.
In 1992? I guess he could have. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the TV series. Of course, we've talked about the franchise, the four movies that came after this. You mentioned the theme park. The theme park show, the stunt show, is very popular. I have trivia for it. It is the first theme park in history that used computer-based control systems. In the past, it was all actor-operated control systems and or someone watching it and manually doing it. That stunt show has a lot of computer-based control. So timing and music and effects all done by computer.
Yeah. I noticed something when I was watching this again the other day for the first time in, I don't know, probably 30 years.
What?
The scene where he's teaching and the girl has "Love You" written on her eyelids. I was watching him and I thought, this is Superman Clark Kent. This is
yes,
he is Clark is. Kent and becomes Superman when the glasses come off and the hat goes on.
Take the glasses and you've got it.
Yeah.
That's a perfect key.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mentioned the X-Files because of the ending.
X-Files, definitely.
With the giant warehouse and all the artifacts in it.
And Carter has said in interviews that Raiders was a huge influence on X-Files.
You mentioned that they decided to go with the Lost Ark of the Covenant as the treasure that they're after.
And MacGuffin.
And I was thinking, that's Old Testament, but the one I always think of is the Holy Grail. And then I thought, maybe they didn't do that because of Monty Python. Because that movie came out 4 years prior. And I was like,
maybe.
Yeah. Or 5 years, maybe. So, but I just put Monty Python and the Holy Grail because the Holy Grail essentially is a relic very similar to the Ark of the Covenant. It's a religious relic, for lack of better words.
So, yeah, he's Ark of the Covenant. Then the second one is the crystals, the stones that glow with power that the natives worship, sort of thing. The third one's the Holy Grail. The fourth one is the crystal skull, which is going back to another key I have, which is Chariots of the Gods. That whole ancient artifacts that have mystical meaning sort of thing. Were we visited by, were they created by aliens? Were they created by the gods? Who knows? That was really big in the 80s. So 70s and 80s. So I have Chariots of the Gods.
Chariots of the Gods, man.
Yeah, they practically own South America.
Speaking of 1982 movies, I've got Poltergeist because of two things. One, that picture behind me, the guy's face melting, is very similar to the guy looking in the mirror and pulling his face off in Poltergeist.
Oh, yeah.
But they're both effects keys. The other is when they open the ark and the spirits are flying around and getting into their faces. It looks very similar to the same effects from Poltergeist.
It is. ILM did both.
Okay.
ILM did both effects.
So,
and the effect is done by puppets in water. That's what creates the flow to them. They filmed these puppets of this woman wraith kind of thing in water.
And then her face turns into a skull. Yeah.
A skull. Yeah. That's the other thing, too. ILM did the effects for this movie, and a lot of the effects are practical as well.
Yeah.
They did a lot of practical effects on set, which is great, and still holds up today, even, 40-plus years later, sort of thing.
Like the whole staff revealing.
The Staff of Ra, yeah.
The only thing else I have is stuff I lifted from IMDb. Unless you have something.
Okay. I have Dan Brown.
I don't think
Dan Brown would have a career without freaking Raiders of the Lost Ark because that's what it is.
I've never read those books.
I have. I've read four of them.
Yeah.
And he's good. It's good plotting. It's a good character. Again, it's that kind of Indiana sort of pulled into it, not trained for this kind of assignment sort of hero. Because he's a scholar. He's a linguist. That's what he is. And suddenly he becomes this international secret agent.
Man of mystery.
Sort of thing. Puzzle solver.
I've got that one of the films often credited as inspiration for Raiders is a movie called Secret of the Incas from 1950 starring Charlton Heston.
I saw that in my notes. Yeah.
Damn you.
Yeah.
I've also got that they were bitching and moaning a lot about the heat until they realized that David Lean endured 14 months of it in Tunisia while filming Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, they got to Tunisia and suddenly there's a huge heat wave and it rose to 130 degrees.
Shit.
And there's also a really cool story about that. So, like I said, Spielberg had done all this pre-production. He had storyboarded every single sequence in this entire movie. And he also built miniatures. So they built miniatures of the locations and he could take and go around with his fingers and look at camera angles that he wanted and everything else. They get to Tunisia. He originally had budgeted for 2,000 extras for the digging scene, the big, huge digging, the 2 days they show them digging and everything else. He ended up with 600. They're all Tunisians. They're all hired local, right? Because all we need you to do is stand in the sun and dig.
Yeah.
But to make it work right, he had three assistant directors. He had them take the miniature, break it into a grid pattern, go out and give every single Tunisian a flag because they don't speak English. They speak Tunisian or whatever Moroccan language they speak.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it took them 4 hours to set up, we want you to stand right here and dig. And we put your little flag in the ground right here. You will be here. You dig here. Okay, good. Stay. Great. Go to the next guy. You come here. Okay, on my map, I take you. You're 2 feet over here. You're going to dig right here. 4 hours to do this. Orchestrated. The AD calls lunch. Every one of the Tunisians picks up their flag and goes to lunch. So Spielberg lost the entire morning. And he has to shoot it in the morning. So now we have to figure out what to do this afternoon because we can't shoot it. We have to set it up again tomorrow morning so we can shoot it in the afternoon tomorrow. Because they have to shoot in the afternoon, sorry, when the sun is setting. So it was a great story that he told in a couple of conventions about how, and they did their right job. They were told to stay with your flag. You stay with your flag. Don't move over there and talk to him. Stay with your flag. We need you for this shot. And so they stayed with their flags, even through lunch. They picked them up and went to lunch.
Crazy.
The last keys I've got are games. It also influenced games. So you have games like Uncharted, Tomb Raider, which ended up becoming even a movie series sort of thing. But all of those were influences of Raiders of the Lost Ark. An archaeologist, except it's a girl now, and she's on international adventure sort of thing. And then all the directors that have said that this movie influenced their work, and you can tell. So J.J. Abrams, Brad Bird, who did The Incredibles, who said he was influenced not only by James Bond, but by Raiders in doing both The Incredibles films. Gore Verbinski, of course, who did Pirates of the Caribbean, has said that. And Eric Kripke, I think you pronounce it Kripke? It's the guy that did Supernatural, the series that lasted on television for 18 seasons or whatever.
Yeah, a long time.
He said that his whole inspiration for Supernatural was essentially his brothers were looking for ancient artifacts. They just happened to be supernatural, not just mystical.
Interesting.
Like Raiders. So, yeah.
I forgot. I have John Ford's Stagecoach from 1939.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Because of the stunt with the truck. That was a stunt they lifted and recreated with a vehicle instead of a... They're both vehicles. One's a stagecoach, one's a truck.
Yep.
So that was a very famous stunt. And then lastly, I have something very weird that you haven't mentioned, and I'm surprised. Because there's a big paragraph on it on IMDb. Apparently, both Lucas and Spielberg were inspired by Carl Banks, who is an artist known for doing the Disney Ducks cartoons. Have you heard about this?
I have not.
Okay, I'm going to read it then because you're going to find this interesting. Exploring a lost temple, Donald Duck, his nephews, and Scrooge McDuck must evade a succession of booby traps like flying darts, a decapitating blade, a huge boulder, a tunnel flooded with a torrent of gushing water, etc. In the story, the prize of Pizarro, Uncle Scrooge, number 26, hit the newsstands when Lucas and Spielberg, both avowed fans of that comic books, were respectively 15 and 12 years old. Another Barks story, The Seven Cities of Cibola, which is Uncle Scrooge number 7 from 1954, has a Native American lost city and a valuable idol that triggers a giant round rock to smash everything in its way. So all of these are like old Disney comic books.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
So it sounds like they lifted a lot from old Disney comic books of Donald Duck's family being adventurers.
Yeah. Interesting.
It's very strange.
I did not know that. That is good.
Yeah, I'm going to put a link if I can find some of those issues in the show notes. Not the show notes, but on the website. But yeah.
Oh, and just going back to my notes, one last thing is we mentioned all the that this was a collaborative thing, but Solcom's lighting and his production design, the music, blah, blah, blah. But we didn't mention sound design, which I think actually won the Academy Award, you said. And that's Ben Burtt, who did all the Star Wars, who did a lot of, I think he's even gone on to Marvel now, but he's, or at least Pixar, I know. But you listen to Indiana Jones, the gunshots don't sound like gunshots in other movies. They have like a double recoil. They have like a kind of sound to him. And when he's hitting people, it sounds different. It doesn't sound like
I read that they used like a baseball bat against something padded. Like something leather and padded.
And they would just go, when he hits people, it goes. You know, that's kind of thing. So the sound design all the way through this is great and excellent. So, yeah, it deserved the Academy Award for it.
Yep. For sure. That's all I have as far as keys. It's our 300th episode.
One of the greatest movies ever made. Love this movie. Let's watch it. Let's do it again next week.
No, we have to do Temple of Doom.
Oh, okay. We'll ooh.
Floating eyeball like soup and monkey brains.
Monkey brains.
Yeah, not a good movie. And I read that mine train sequence in Temple of Doom was supposed to be in this movie. And that's one of the things I hate about Temple of Doom, because that whole jumping the track and landing back on the track, I'm like, no.
Nope. Yeah, the two scenes that were planned for this movie, for Raiders, that were cut were the mine train and the opening. The whole, which is not the opening in Raiders, it was halfway through, but they actually have a Singapore dance number, Berkeley sort of thing, which is how they open Temple of Doom. Also, these movies are known for Spielberg's wonderfully imaginative shot of the opening mirrors the Paramount Mountain logo. Every first shot does. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. There we are.
All right. Well, that's what we have for our 300th episode. We hope you enjoyed it. We hope you enjoy this film. God knows we do. If you have a differing opinion or want to praise it, we would love to hear what you had to say in the comments down below. And while you're down there, please give us a thumbs up and like or share us. If you would like to share us, we are out for the masses to be shared. If you like what you found with us here today, we have other things. There's some other short shows that we have on YouTube. And if you really want to help support us, we do have a Patreon channel where there is a lot of free stuff about David and I, as well as bonus episodes, which are usually outtakes that come before we shoot these, because we do tend to warm up with conversation. And also there are some paid tiers over there. If you like sci-fi or horror television, we've got two running of Star Trek, the original series called The Dilithium Chamber. We are in the third season of that. And we have The X-Files Declassified, which we have done 4 seasons of. And we take those episodes one by one. So you've got a lot of material over there. If you're into those shows, we would love to have you come see us. And until next week, David, where I have – oh, we'll be doing a double feature. I do know that.
Ooh.
And it's a little sci-fi, a little horror, a little bit of both.
Our 301st.
Yeah, our 301st episode. And I will see you then.
Perfect. All right. See you then. Bye-bye.